Okay, let's get going here. We got three presentations to get through. This is Artists and Repertory Pop, and just make sure you're in the correct venue. I'm Conrad Strauss. I'm not going to introduce myself because I'm not really important, but I am going to introduce our speakers. You have to come to my paper that I'm giving tomorrow at 11:45, then you'll learn all about me. Okay, so we're going to start with Daniel Beaumont, and he's going to be presenting My Black Mama, The Influence and Significance of Sunhouse Records. Daniel studied English literature at the University of Washington and medieval Arabic literature at Princeton. He teaches at the University of Rochester, courses on Arabic literature, a course on Marx, Nietzsche, and Freud. And of course, the history and influence of the blues. Nietzsche played blues guitar, didn't he? I'm pretty sure he did. Yes, he did. Yes. Yeah. Robert Johnson actually learned from him, I believe. He's the author of Slave of Desire, Sex, Love, and Death in the 1001 Nights, and Preaching the Blues, The Life and Times of Sunhouse.
Thank you, Conrad, for the introduction. What I'm going to do is, this is sort of grown out of some passing remarks in my book that came out last year, the biography of Eddie Sunhouse. I'm going to play for you three songs. I've edited them down for the presentation. My Black Mama by Sunhouse, part one, the first thing he ever recorded in the sessions in... just a little bit. There we go. Grafton, Wisconsin. Then I'm going to play a song by Muddy Waters, and then we're going to end with a rock and roll song, which I will leave for later to introduce. What I want to do is sort of show how the blues were translated from a music made for a specifically, really, in almost entirely black audience in its early days, and how it was translated into another kind of music in the so-called blues revival of the 60s, which really wasn't a revival. It's kind of a misnomer. It was really the discovery of the blues by a young white audience, and what that audience made of the blues, and why it wasn't simply coincidence that it all happened in the 60s. So what I should say, I guess I'll start out by saying a few things about the Sunhouse's life in the context of the blues. One of the things I realized when I was writing the book was that his life is basically coterminous with the history of the music. He was born in 1902. The blues probably came into existence in the decade before that. He remembered his dad playing blues when he was a kid. His parents separated when he was quite young, however, and he went with his mother, and his mother was apparently very religious, and he absorbed that from her. And he remembered in his childhood, after he left his father, that he always scorned the music, the blues. He said he couldn't stand the sight of a man with a guitar. Now, one of the things that Lawrence Levine, in his really groundbreaking work, Black Culture, Black Consciousness, emphasized was the blues as one of the things that helped to create a secular culture in the African American communities in the South. Up to that point, really, the only institution in the rural communities of the South of the blacks had been the church. And really, the only professional that most of the African American people knew was the preacher. And Levine emphasized how the blues man was a secular rival to the preacher. And hence the moniker, the devil's music, which the blues quickly earned. It went beyond simply the subject matter, the places it was played, and so forth. It was rather the hostility on the part of the church towards what had come to be a secular rival to it. And all through his youth, Sunhouse was clearly on the side of the church. He preached at a very early age. He was probably 15 when first time he stood in the pulpit. And he went on like that for several years. He was always, during this time, however, he had to work at various menial jobs, sharecropping, working on levees, and the kinds of labor that was available to blacks in the South then. And one of the things that I tried to explain, how did he end up becoming a blues man suddenly, probably around 1927, when he had this whole history of scorn for the music and this sort of thing. And I analyzed that in terms of him feeling that he was at an impasse in his life. He got his own church probably in the early 20s, but at some point he ran off with a woman from the congregation. And probably stayed in North Louisiana for a while. He came back, he started preaching again. He had already started drinking before he took up the blues. And one of the things he said about his preaching career, it came in kind of oblique ways, but he emphasized that the money was easy money. He emphasized how important his beliefs were and all this kind of thing, but he also talked a lot about the money. And it was clear that when he talked about the other kinds of work that was available, that he hated that. It was, sharecropping was basically a legalized form of slavery, and there was nothing in it for him. And so when I tried to explain what happened very suddenly, probably about 1927 or 28, I looked at this as though he felt that he was in a deadlock, and there were really only three positions in it. There was preaching, there was menial labor, and there was this new thing, being a blues musician. He had worked at hard jobs. He was an intelligent man who found that very unsatisfying. He knew it led nowhere. He'd been preaching, and he was already having trouble staying in the pulpit. He's walking past a house party sometime, probably on a Saturday night in like 1927, 28. He hears the sound of a bottleneck guitar. He goes closer to the crowd, and the next day he goes out and he buys a beat up old guitar. Within a few days, he's got it put into condition to play, and he starts learning things in an open tuning, G tuning. Within a week or two, he's learned enough songs that he's sort of playing with other bluesmen. So it's this, I explained it in terms of a conversion experience almost. It's like Paul on the road to Damascus, except he's going the other direction. And he was really notable in the history of the blues for this. There were a lot of blues men who got out of the blues and became preachers later in life. It was a hard life, but the skill sets were somewhat the same. He's the only notable one I know who went the other direction, who had been a preacher and ended up becoming a blues man. So he starts playing blues, and it's fitting with the moniker, the devil's music. Soon something bad happens. He ends up shooting and killing a man at a house party, and he ends up being sent to Parchman Farm, the state prison. It's almost always preceded by the word the notorious Parchman Farm, where he languished for probably, it's hard to say, he was there for maybe at least 6 months and maybe more than a year. He was released sometime around 1930, late 29, early 1930, and the judge who released him told him in Clarksdale, where he was born, that he never wanted to see him again in Clarksdale. So he did what any blues man would do. He got his guitar, he jumped on a freight train, and he went 17 miles away. That was far enough in the Mississippi Delta then to be out of range of the judge. He gets off the train in a little town called Lula, which I'm sure you've all heard of. Lula is, you know, about as big as this hotel, probably, in terms of physical space. He starts playing in the depot, and unbeknownst to him, this is a major stroke of good luck. The man who had been the biggest star at Paramount Records the year before, their best-selling artist, Charlie Patton, who had been the king of the Delta blues he'd been playing in the Delta for pushing 20 years by this point, and was well known all over the Delta. Charlie Patton is in Lula. He has made it his new home after he was thrown off a Dockery's plantation for the last time, and he watches Sunhouse perform. Within a few days, they are playing together, drinking together, hanging out, and they become good friends. Since Paramount, he'd been their biggest seller, and they'd lost Lemon Jefferson, who had died the previous year. They wanted to get Charlie Patton back in the studio probably in the spring of 1930. And they gave him, since he was their best seller, pretty much carte blanche to bring anyone he wanted with him. He brings Sunhouse and his friend Willie Brown and a girlfriend named Louise Johnson. They go to Grafton, Wisconsin, and the first thing that Sunhouse recorded was this song, which I'm going to play for you now. And now we say, inshallah. Well, I got to back it up. Here we go. Everything in it's stolen, including that. He recorded that in two parts, the song that was really the theme of his whole life, Preaching the Blues, which was the name I gave the biography. It had to be the title of his life story. And two other songs, and he did a test piece, apparently, of a thing called Walkin' Blues, which was never released. It was only rediscovered well after the war. This great piece of good fortune, he's been in prison and now he's got a recording contract with one of the leading race record companies in the country, falls flat. The Great Depression wipes out the race record industry pretty much, and within a few years Paramount Records was bankrupt. And Sunhouse, as he put it, when it was all over, he said, I was nowhere. I was back in Lula. I was nowhere. He sharecropped throughout the 30s. When Patton died in 34, this trip had made Sunhouse and Willie Brown best friends. He said of Willie Brown that he was closer than a brother. They ended up becoming the best known musicians in the Delta with the death of Charlie Patton, and they played every Saturday night in the Delta throughout the 30s in juke joints and so forth. But there was no more recording contracts, none of that kind of thing, so he was stuck down there. He recorded again, however, in 41-42 for Alan Lomax and the Fisk University Library of Congress project. But those things were archived and sent back to DC, and nobody knew of them except really Alan Lomax and a few other people. In 43, he moved to Rochester, New York. And there's two stories about that, which I won't get into. But it was part and parcel of the migration of black labor to better jobs that had become available due to the war. He moved up here, and my standard line about that was that it was as though he fell off the face of the earth when he moved to Rochester, New York. He got out of music. He worked mostly for the New York Central Railroad for about 10, 12 years, and then retired, so to speak. He had a series of menial jobs up here, and he lived actually not even a mile from here. In Mississippi, he left behind Muddy went to Chicago the same year. One of those major sort of disciples, if we could use that language of him, musically speaking, was a young Muddy Waters. Muddy Waters always cited Sunhouse as his most important influence, bar none. He said of him, he was the king. And he told people in his own band, if it weren't for Sunhouse, I wouldn't be here today. Muddy goes to Chicago, separates from Sunhouse, they lose track of each other. When he starts to record his first big recording, that was a regional hit that made him and set him on the path that would change the course of blues music, not only in Chicago, but around the world eventually, was a song called I Can't Be Satisfied. And you saw the line, it's clearly based on that line in the Sunhouse song. I'm going to play you a bit of that by Muddy right now. This will be louder. Well, you see what's coming next. I meant to cut it off before that. So Muddy, oh, it's not stopping either. Muddy remade Chicago blues and ultimately the blues everywhere with his music he made in Chicago. And one of the bands that was most influenced by him, in fact, if you're going to have two influences on them, Muddy would have to be maybe the first. The only person that could vie with him in importance for the Rolling Stones would be Chuck Berry, another Chess artist. They named themselves after one of Muddy's songs, Rolling Stone, which is a version of an old Mississippi blues called Catfish Blues. And they were just saturated in his music. One of the things I talked about when I discussed Sunhouse's first recording in the book was that what comes out of him, well, the first time he gets in front of a mic and he's got this chance. And it's as in the emotion I said was rage. It's as though all the frustrations in his life to that point are coming out in this powerful performance. That he's that good at that point when he'd been in prison for a while and he hung out with musical nobodies until he met Charlie Patton. That he was that good was astonishing. You see that anger is clearly picked up on in the Muddy Waters song as well. I can't be satisfied. Just talk about it. And it's anger in both songs directed at a woman. When we get down the line here, and one of the things I talked about, the opening chapter of the book, was about the rediscovery and the way that a young white audience was trying to understand and grasp this music. The three people that went down to Mississippi to look for Sunhouse on a mistaken tip, Dick Waterman, Phil Spiro, and Nick Pearls, were all young white Jewish fans of blues music. They went down there in June of 64, the same summer of the Mississippi burning summer, as some would call it now after the movie. And it was one of the things I learned from Steve Colt was that Nick Pearls knew Goodman. They had gone to the same prep school in Manhattan. And I thought, what an amazing coincidence. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, it wasn't as amazing a coincidence as you'd think. Because their interest coming at this point in this music, that it coincided with the civil rights movement and the heavy participation of Jewish people in the civil rights movement, made it not as much of a coincidence as you would think. And the fact that they were happening at the same time, it was all part of this larger opening up and breaking down of this barrier, this wall, that had existed between these two communities. So they happened to be in Memphis the day, as a matter of fact, the three men were murdered by the Klan or the Sheriff's Department, which in Neshoba County was the same thing. But it was sort of the coincidence, it wasn't a coincidence. as much as you think. And it wasn't a coincidence that the blues started to find this young white audience in the 60s at the same time either. When you think they were looking, it was a time when they, so many young people were dissatisfied with huge issues, the Vietnam War, civil rights, sexual mores, all these things we know. And they were looking for artistic expressions that were far, that were free of those kinds of associations. And if you were looking for a music that was as far removed from middle class white America at that point, the blues would be it. It was a music that had been born in a community that was completely separated from that. And so they responded to it in a way, they found in it something that it, maybe it wasn't there for the original black audience, but it wasn't as though they just created it or projected it on it. And one of the things that happened with it is this song, if we can back it up just slightly. Is it doing it for me?
No.
Oh, it's got to wake up here. Okay, here we go. I'll stop it there so that I have a little more time to finish up here. One of the things, I'm going to read you a quote from Mick Jagger now about this song. He says, "It was the song that really made the Rolling Stones, changed us from just another band into a huge monster band. It has a very catchy title, it has very catchy guitar riff, and it has a great guitar sound," he means the fuzz tone that was used, which was original at that time. "And it captures a spirit of the times, which is very important in those kinds of songs, which was alienation." And the point I wanted to make when I started teaching this thing in my blues class and so forth was that how they took that anger and rage in that song, and because Mick Jagger is a clever songwriter and an intelligent person, and they translated it into something that expressed this whole sort of zeitgeist or whatever you want to call it, the mood of the 60s, and captured that in this song. Interestingly enough, and you can see the talk of the lyrics about kind of commercial culture and the anger it engenders in the singer, but it comes around again at the end of the song to being about a woman and his dissatisfaction with her. So it really goes like full circle with this song, and that's exactly what happened really with the blues. It was discovered by this young white audience at this point, and they read in it, and it somehow perfectly addressed the mood, their mood about American life at that point. And it changed the history of music, obviously. There's something I just learned about the other day I'm going to end here with. By coincidence, they recorded that song in Los Angeles, I think on May 12th, 1965. It was their first number one hit in America. It lasted 4 weeks in the summer and was knocked off the charts by Herman's Hermits, "I'm Henry VIII." I think Muddy would have been in sympathy with them. But they met Sunhouse 2 days later. I don't know, they had certainly known of Sunhouse by that point because they knew about Robert Johnson. And Robert Johnson's reissue in 63 had mentioned Sunhouse as one of his influences. They met Sunhouse. They were doing the Shindig television show, and Sunhouse was playing at the UCLA Folk Festival. they had made a condition of doing the song that they could either would have Muddy Waters with them or Howlin' Wolf. They had Howlin' Wolf on national TV, Shindig. Howlin' Wolf and Son House had known each other. They had dated sisters back in Mississippi. They were reunited on the set of Shindig with the Rolling Stones. That's my talk. Thank you. Conrad tells me there's a couple of minutes left, so if there's any questions, I'd be happy to address them. Or donate my time. yeah.
You moved here, you said, when?
In 43.
Right, but when did he start performing again?
That was in he was rediscovered in June of 64, and he started playing by, he started doing gigs in August of 64. And he had this whole second career that was totally unforeseen. Dick Waterman, who's a friend of mine now, he pulled off a coup, really. He got him a recording contract with Columbia Records, which may still be the gold standard of American record companies. And he recorded an album for Columbia the next year, 1965. So, and then they had a run of about 5-6 years.
Did he die in Rochester?
No, he lived here until 1976, and at that point he hadn't been performing for some years, and he was too much for his wife Evie to handle, and they moved her and son to Detroit, where she had stepchildren. House never had any children of his own, and he died in Detroit in 1988. He had a remarkably long life considering his habits. He was a ferocious drinker. I never did. He played in Seattle, but I missed him when I was a teenager. And now I know so many people that knew him from being here in Rochester. That's what led me to actually, I knew when I moved here, I'd been listening to his stuff for years, and I probably had read that he lived here. I knew he was dead, I knew he'd moved away. And it just, to me, it was like, the thing I compare it to is like the Middle Ages or something. It was just like a world that was dead and gone. It was really through meeting, first of all, Joe Beard, blues musician, who's also from Mississippi, and who was his neighbor here when they rediscovered him. It was through meeting Joe and getting to know Joe that I started to think like, well, really, it's not gone. There's a story here. In this town, there were so many people that knew him, and he really, he became a celebrity in this town after his rediscovery. He still is, in a way. Really? Yeah. It's funny, I still keep having these experiences. I'll run into somebody, some years ago, a man lived on the same street I live on. We were just standing out on the sidewalk on a summer evening talking. His name was Tommy, and I made a documentary about Joe Beard that airs on cable access, and he was watching it in the middle of the night, and I come on the screen, and Joe, and all this stuff, and he goes like, I knew Son House, he used to buy shoes from me. And my landlord saw him when I lived in an apartment. It was just, I keep running into people like that. I've met now a woman, she's almost 100 years old, who knew him in Mississippi. And I've interviewed her. It only came about because I published the book. But he changed the city in a significant way. Thank you, Conrad. Thank you all.